That was Lost at Last, and the song was called Kachina. And now, as promised, we are in Planet Waves FM studio with Daniel Sternstein, the one-time host of the Music Appreciation Hour, co-host, that is, and still my music teacher, who has been in Israel for a couple of weeks.
Oh, yes.
There for the whole Charlie Hebdo massacre thing. So you actually got to see, experience that news from the viewpoint of the other side of the world, basically.
Yeah. It was definitely heavily televised in Israel immediately as it started going on, as you can imagine. And what had happened was I had just gotten to Tel Aviv the day before. I had spent the week before in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was beautiful. And then we had the storm of the decade, which was about a half an inch of snow. And they close all the major highways for about a half an inch of snow in Israel.
That's because they only have one snowplow.
Exactly. His name is Moses or Frank or something.
Like,
everybody knows this one guy.
15 days to plow the entire country.
Kind of. You put salt down. There's one salt guy and one plow guy.
And one pepper guy.
Exactly. And they don't work in such cold. All right. So anyway, so I spent the week in Jerusalem, and then I got to Tel Aviv. So I met this great—actually, he's in the reserves. He's in the Givati reserves. So the Givati is infantry, basically, and the infantry that serves in Gaza, if I'm not mistaken. I think Golani serves up north in the West Bank, and he's in Givati. So he's front lines, Gaza Strip. So we're sitting there. I mean, we were having a day in Tel Aviv. I basically just had put my bags down in Tel Aviv. And here goes the news off on what was going on for Charlie Hebdo, which was crazy in and of itself. But what had actually happened was I didn't see the actual Charlie Hebdo massacre with them. This is actually had already happened the day before as I was traveling. What we had caught was the mess afterwards, which was this was all going on and being talked about in Israel.
It went on for 3 days. It went on from Wednesday morning to Friday evening.
The siege, I would call it, as I guess they were calling it, at the supermarket, really. And this, it all, you know, it felt like it was one big event as people were mourning these guys from Charlie Hebdo. Obviously, the siege at the supermarket happened with Koulibaly. So this is what we saw kind of live, and we actually were glued to the TV throughout that day. So anyway, what I'd noticed was the first interesting thing that this Givati Shmuel, his name was, this Givati said was, I've been waiting for this to happen for 3 years now, which was scary already to hear somebody say it, something like that. But what he meant was this has been going on. And obviously, there's been growing anti-Semitism in Europe, and there's been attacks going on. And obviously, it really came to a head with this. So, I mean, yeah, this is kind of what I got to experience from Israel. I guess we can, you know, go into it. Obviously, we have different opinions on what went down that day.
Well, I'm not sure what happened, actually. And I have learned from a lot of years as a journalist and then this other kind of journalist that I've become to keep an open mind.
Sure.
And to always question the official narrative. There's always an event, and then we're given a narrative, and generally everyone believes it. And my policy as a human being is to just question that narrative. Whether it's those dorms are safe, and they're safe because the government says they're safe, or whether it's a lot of environmental stuff. I mean, when you see the kinds of blatant lies that are told on environmental issues where lives are at stake, it's not just money that's at stake. It's kids and people and their sure. pets and their lives. So that's really where I'm coming from, is to not swallow the story whole, but to take it apart and, you know, on one level, it's just more TV and internet, right? I mean, that's how most people experience it, is a thing on the other end of the internet or the television screen.
Right.
I did not personally see the bodies. And I think there's something to be said for seeing the bodies and seeing positive identification of bodies. Because you don't know.
Sure.
Who it was, unless there's actual positive identification and you've seen the dead body. I mean,
right.
So,
well, I think the scariest thing for me was, and it was even scarier than actually being in Israel at the time of this and seeing, I mean, what felt like a wave of anti-Semitism, talk about anti-Semitism for the day. What was scarier was as I was waking up a few hours later, you know, or as rather my friends in the U.S. were waking up a few hours later, so we're 7 hours ahead, right, in Israel, seeing a lot of these Facebook posts immediately from people in Vermont and from people right in Kingston and Woodstock immediately saying, have we questioned that this could be an inside job from Israel? Have we questioned? And I realized a lot of these people are, you know, considered, you know, human activists or hippies or something like this, or musicians, you know, or somebody like you who might come out and say, you know, have we questioned Mossad? And what we don't understand is how powerful saying something like that can be on social media, even inferring something like that, because a lot of people really are not informed, are really ignorant, and tend to listen to, obviously people like you are very influential, but people like, you know, people that live in Woodstock and that are considered hippies or human activists are now, you're supposed to be sensitive to the human condition and are coming out with what feels to be, to me, quiet anti-Semitism. And that's what was scary while being there, you know?
Right.
And we have the pleasure of being able to do that in America. We have the pleasure of being able to take it apart and saying, you know, we're so comfortable here that we can say, oh, you know, George Bush did this. George Bush took down the Twin Towers, or, you know, some sort of sweeping generalization like that. Whereas when you're in Israel and something like this is going on and everybody has been in the military and most of these kids are not Mossad, you know, these kids are Israeli residents, you know, living
for... The Mossad is, first of all, not a Jewish institution. It is a very powerful intelligence...
Sure.
And military organization.
Sure.
That happens to be part of a very smart government.
Sure.
That is impressively able to survive in these conditions. By these conditions, I mean all of these conditions, going back from pre-World War II all the way till the present moment. And so... Plus, they don't really get blamed with a lot. I mean, this is the first time I've ever heard, and really, I haven't heard, and I've been very cautious about that, by the way. I mean, I'm more open about it privately. I don't know who did this.
Right.
And I have only commented in one Facebook comment, not like a Facebook post or an article or something. So I, in a very understated way, I stated... my opinion, based on the available facts and based on which way this tipping point event is going to tip things.
Sure.
And it is a geopolitical event. It is something that is going to rearrange all of the whole concept of the European government, the whole concept of the war on terrorism, the whole concept of this... what I think is a horribly misguided policy of waging this so-called anti-terrorist war at huge personal, like human cost, financial cost, cost of freedom, cost of the future. I think the whole thing is for shit.
Well, my fear is that people thinking like this, that are trying to think about all the complexities of the, you know, geopolitical issue, are ignoring the fact that there are straight ahead vicious killers in our midst, meaning these extremist fundamentalists, Islamic and other, and Christians and Jews, they can be dangerous, but that we're ignoring the fact that yes, these people are right in front of us now and that they are in France, you know, and that's I think people have totally ignored that fact around here.
Okay. And there is the hypothesis that I'm aware of that is probably concurred on a fairly high level in counterinsurgency business, which is that France, among a couple of other countries in Europe, had their head stuffed up their ass about this. That is the official line pretty much if you talk to somebody who's in this business, that's pretty much what they're going to tell you, is that if France had it coming to them, it's because they have refused to acknowledge this threat. And let's just call that theory one. You know, let's just say, all right, straight up, prima facie, what we were told happened, and here's what that was. And that is a plausible story. I mean, that's the thing about this, about the official version of events, is it is plausible.
Sure.
But there are questions. I mean, for example, a simple question. If this magazine had been targeted before, which it was firebombed in 2011, you would think that it was going to be a known target. It's a soft target. It is not able to defend itself. You might want to harden that up a little bit. You might want to act to prevent that. And under the France had its head up its ass theory, they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like they were wholly unprepared for that situation, which makes it all the more scary. And, you know, they're saying record amounts of French Jews are applying for Aliyah and trying to get out of the country at this point.
Yeah, which doesn't mean that they are responding to a real threat. You know, I mean, a lot of that's political movement. A lot of that's, well, I've had enough. I've always wanted to do this. There's nobody who's going to pick up and claim their prerogative to go to Israel who hasn't thought about it before. I think, you know, just like, you're not just an established, in my fantasy world, you're not just an established Parisian living your life, and then just one day you say, oh, now it's time to go to Israel.
Right. But I think that people feel as though they can be safe in Israel, that there's they're protecting Jews in Israel the way they don't feel in France and in a lot of Europe right now. And, you know, that's what I think. I mean, people think that, I mean, and the other scary thing is that there are a lot of scared Jews out there. And I think that a lot of people are not worrying about their pleas because of what I believe is this anti-Zionist movement going on. And there is a lot of anti-Zionist sentiment around here.
Okay, let's take one step back and question whether Charlie Hebdo attack was an attack on France or an attack on Jews.
Right.
I mean, there were Jews killed, but in, you know, in any Western urban metropolitan center, when there's a mass murder, there's going to be a couple of Jews around, because it's, you know, just saying.
We tend to habitate there.
Yeah, deadheads and stuff. Yeah. You know. So that's a deadhead joke because we're everywhere. It's kind of like, you know, but in urban centers, you know, but anyway, I think I made that point. So I don't see this as an attack on Jews. You might be able to get me over that hump that it was an attack on Jews rather than an attack on France or an attack on people who made fun of the Prophet Muhammad.
Right.
And everybody else. See, that's the thing. Like, they were certainly equal opportunity satire artists.
Well, I certainly what happened was, I mean, I can't tell you if the Charlie Hebdo attacks were an attack on Jews, but what they're saying now is that this lone wolf who claims that he was with ISIS, who is completely plausible for me, as I believe it, as this guy, he's in a video saying that I'm a part of this caliphate and I'm with ISIS. And he goes into a kosher supermarket and starts killing people. I believe that's an attack on Jews. I believe that's an attack to scare Jews.
That would count.
That definitely counts.
I mean, and
so I can say by that time, and he was also saying, now I don't believe, you know, I can't, again, there are questions, but he was saying, you know, it was a good thing that we managed to calibrate our attacks to be around the same time. Now, I don't know if he was also just a crazy person and the Charlie Hebdo was a different thing, but what it felt like when it's going on, you know, it feels like one big siege. And I can certainly say that the kosher supermarket was the event that affected Israel even more, because, again, you don't know whether the Charlie Hebdo attack is an attack on France, an attack on Jews, attack on Zionism, attack on freedom of speech, but certainly going into a kosher supermarket and starting to shoot it up. I mean, he knew, he was a French, spoke French. So anyway, by the time this was going on, it certainly felt like, hey, this is a Muslim attack. There's no reason for the Mossad, quote unquote, to go into a kosher supermarket and kill four kids or send somebody in, send some sort of operative or patsy in to go and kill four kids. So at that time, it felt like, oh, okay, this is definitely straightforward and this is scary more than anything. Not even thinking about the geopolitical issues, thinking about simply how scary it is for somebody to be living in what is considered an international city and a tolerant city, although we know largely it's not, and to have an attack like this go on. And then the reaction to be, oh, no, this is definitely Israel attacking France because they voted to recognize Palestine. I think it's ludicrous. And I heard it a lot. I heard it a lot. It's a lot from right here, right at home.
Yeah.
And that's what was scary, to be over there and to be a part of it as a Jew, but to be a visitor, you know, a real visitor, and see how, not scared. I mean, the Israelis are not a scared people, but to see that they're dealing with this and they're understanding that now Europe has to deal with this too, and for Americans to brush it off like that. I think now is not the time to brush it off.
Okay, so there's two things going on with what I call the false flag meme, right? In the year since 9/11, it has become fashionable to claim that things were false flag. And some of these theories are, I would say they're pretty insane. I mean, the theory that, for example, the Newtown shooting was false flag, by which the people who said that meant that the whole thing didn't actually happen.
Right. I heard about this craziness.
Okay. So that's one, you know, that's one version of false flag, and it goes around and around. And during the Newtown massacre aftermath, I spent a lot of time with a lot of this I did right on Facebook, fact-checking things. And for example, when the myth that the whole thing didn't happen started to propagate, right? Mm-hmm. I started checking funeral notices. Like I asked somebody on the Planet Waves team to get me, say, 10 funeral notices. I want death notices and burial notices and funeral service times. And having not been there, you know, having not been at the crime scene, that was as far as I could go to verify. Now, there are probably death certificates. We could go further. But once all these funerals happened, and I know someone who has a relative who was the FBI guy in charge of that incident. I knew somebody from the New York Times who I've corresponded with over the years, who I met through the Red Goat thing. And I stayed in touch with him throughout the whole thing. And my question for him was, does this seem, everything seem kosher here? Everything seem all right? I would imagine that somebody I had been in touch with over a period of time at the New York Times, with a great track record at the Times, not accused of fraud or anything like that, just your average Times lifer, would notice something off, like it didn't even happen. But my thing is, I like to debunk the conspiracy theories. That's really the approach I take, more than to create the conspiracy theories.
And you're saying you found these death notices?
Yeah, found the death notices. And my friend at the Times didn't reply and say, yeah, this seems a little odd.
Right.
But that's just an example of how kind of out there the false flag thing can get. But it's become commonplace to accuse every last thing that happens of being false flag.
Sure.
And I think this speaks about an underlying mistrust of government and an understanding that, as I.F. Stone said, governments lie. I mean, I just saw a video today of the CIA testifying about how basically it has journalists in 75. This was in the aftermath of Watergate, when there was a kind of a truth in government transparency moment in the United States for a few years, and we got the Freedom of Information Act through and all this stuff. And I knew about this, but they plant journalists throughout, you know, CIA operative journalists throughout the media networks. I mean, so there is a huge amount of activity of this kind of spy shit, as I call it, this spy shit. And it's cost a lot of money and a lot of lives. And it results in never really knowing what's true. And Americans all know that. And they, whether they know it or not, they know about COINTELPRO, the program to destroy the lives of activists and under which John Lennon was followed around and Martin Luther King was followed around and basically everybody was followed around. There was like unlimited budget. So we know that. That finally ends, again, in the wake of Watergate. But people know their government does fucked up things. And there have been a lot of examples of this. I mean, I don't know what the latest surveys on what people believe, whether people believe that 9/11 was an inside job, but there is a very high number, close to a majority of people, who are suspicious of the whole thing. And I think whatever actually happened is one thing, but the public perception when asked is another thing. And people know that a lot of bullshit is flung, a lot of propaganda is flung. It's just that somehow that fact never seems to be legitimized. Or if it is, it's in a very quiet way. You know, Rachel Maddow can put on some wacky 9/11 truther who's selected, obviously, for her idiot value, because she seems dopey, rather than, for example, putting in architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, who have scientific evidence of what did and didn't happen, because it's people who design skyscrapers for a living and make them stand up.
Sure.
So what I'm saying is the false flag meme is powerful and it's prevalent. And on some level, whether they're misguided or not, whether they're smart or stupid, a lot of people do question these things when they happen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the scariest thing, I think, and the thing is that, you know, being in Israel, I feel like Israelis want people to understand what they're going through. And and it's certainly complex.
So what would you say that is? What would you say that is? I mean,
they're going through war. I mean, they're going through war. They're going through crazy. I mean, and it's not like it's a new problem by any means, but it's just so happens that I'm alive now. I'm seeing it now. And what's happening is that they feel as though the international community is not with them. And I think many of them feel that Bibi, Benjamin Netanyahu, is a big part of that. I think they like, you know, a lot of Israelis like what Benjamin Netanyahu is doing as far as keeping the country safe. And, you know, certainly he's right wing. He's a Likud thing. But he is not good at getting the international community behind him. And I think to the detriment of many Israelis who are actually trying to live a peaceful life.
No, I think what happened in the Gaza Strip last year was, whatever the military strategy might have been, it was horrendous public relations to Definitely. Have this perpetuated, vicious emergency. And then you hear, oh, the trucks with like medical supplies can't get in. And because they're worried that they might be. And look, you know, My dad's wife is Israeli. I know some of this, like, chomp down on it, and we have to fight to the bitter end, no matter what point of view.
Sure.
It's a little myopic. I mean, I have to say, I mean, Israel chose to plant itself in the middle of its most vicious enemies. After it got done with the Holocaust, the Holy Land was surrounded by, you know, name off the countries, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Jordan and Lebanon and Libya. So it's like this joke in the Onion's book, Our Dumb Century, about how like war-weary Jews seek new home amidst all their worst enemies, basically. And, you know, part of the lack of sympathy for the Jewish plight is the question, like, why is this always happening? Like, why is the whole story the story of beleaguered persecution? That itself is not anti-Semitism. That is a story of, like, if you have a friend who has, like, 26 girlfriends who steal their money and beat them up, eventually you start to wonder, like, what they're doing choosing people like this after a while.
I'm not saying it's beleaguered persecution. I don't think Israelis feel like that either. I don't feel like that's the story anymore. In fact, I feel it's the opposite. I feel as though they have the control now. It's certain that they do. And they're not willing to give it up. You know, they're in a place of power right now, and maybe in a place of relative comfort, knowing that, okay, the wall is up and you got to go through checkpoints now. The Intifada is over for now. It's actually relatively quiet in Israel right now.
Yep.
You know, and I think that only adds to the lack of sympathy or empathy for. And it's not Jewish plight. I mean, nobody feels as though it's Jewish plight. The problem comes in is when the Jews finally decide to defend themselves. What I believe is the Jewish people defending themselves. And, you know, there's a huge movement for the underdogs, like there always is for underdogs, which are the Palestinians. All right. And so I don't feel as though people are really trying to understand what's going on there. And it comes down to largely what people are posting on social media. And that's what's scary for me, is a lot of ignorance that's going on, where this could be. This could be, you know, and you said it yourself, it's plausible. This could be a straightforward incident where this crazy fundamentalist Islamic fighter comes in and kills Jews. And everybody thinks that that it's Jews that are doing it, or that it's the Mossad. That's
the supermarket siege. See, that one didn't seem to me anyway so
strange.
Strange. No, that. If anything, it kind of stood out because it almost seemed organic. It almost seemed like actual terrorism. It didn't have
It
didn't have the made for TV feeling. But the Jewish supermarket, the kosher supermarket thing. I mean, there was a terrorist attack in Paris in, I guess this was when, maybe in the 90s, of a kosher restaurant, right? So. And, you know, the history of France is very complicated on these things. I mean, they were very much in line with the Nazis. France rolled over, and I forget the famous police chief's name, I'm drawing a blank on it now, who was involved in the 1961 massacre on the Algerians, was a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
And the French just rolled over. I mean, that's how the French, you know, to put it politely, they rolled over, and the Marais emptied out. I mean, I lived in Paris. There's a Holocaust memorial on every street. I mean every third house. Like, you look, that Jewish person lived there. That they were taken away. That you just walk down the street of Paris, mm-hmm. and if you walk slowly enough to notice that there's plaques on many of these houses indicating some kind of historical significance to that place. Yeah. And that is scary. I think that France has that very well documented history. And then as went on to basically have a massacre in Algeria. And then their Nazi police chief slaughters a bunch of peaceful protesters in 61 and throws their bodies into the Seine, or herds them into the Seine.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, if you're not exactly on one side or the other, it starts to seem like a bunch of killing for its own sake. Like, people who are just a bunch of killers just kill, and that's what killers do.
Right.
Just like you and I like music, and artists like to make art, there seems to be a lot of people who are just into this whole killing thing. And even though it's illegal, I mean, and immoral, they do it.
Right. Well, you know, what was genuinely interesting about it was being inside of Israel and seeing it go on. And you know, I'm an Israeli citizen. I have dual citizenship. So I have nationalist feelings towards Israel. I was raised Jewish. So I don't have an objective point of view. But what I do see, and what I have seen from my experience, is that that Israelis really want to live in peace one way or another. That's the and it's not the case with fundamentalist Islam.
I would agree with that. I would love to go to Israel and check it out there. Now, I only have secondhand accounts. My father describes it as an incredibly tolerant society in Israel.
Yeah, it's a democratic society.
Yeah, but like, if you're Arab in Israel, everybody leaves you alone. No one's trying to, no one harasses you.
They
if
work
you're Christian,
there every day.
If you're
40,000 Palestinians work there every day.
All of the holy sites are basically respected. And now this is, you know, it's to some degree hearsay and a matter of perception. Whereas all of these Islamist charters of all these different like groups and subsets and there's numerous ones have our goal is to eliminate Israel, right? That's
and,
actually
and
in,
Jews.
In the charter.
And people that don't follow Allah, that don't follow Sharia law, right. on some of these really extreme groups. And that's what's getting scary to me now, because as a Jew, it's starting to become very real to see that something like this can happen in France. And I do think, you know, I don't think it was an attack on Jews, maybe, this Charlie Hebdo cover, but it's certainly scary to see that Jews are not their only target, that these are people, these are cartoonists, simply not following the same laws that they are, and that it's not the first time that this has happened. And so to say, oh, this might be an inside job, to say this is a maybe a CIA job, is to completely ignore the fact that there is a serious threat that are killing people every day, and even worse, putting it over on some sort of anti-government mindset.
I don't think it's to ignore that. I think that it's an acknowledgement of the fact that there is some opportunism that might be involved. That, oh, this is a known enemy, so I'm going to make it look like they did it. I mean, this is sort of an old trick in the fighting handbook of like right. messing with
but I
people
but I do to, feel I do feel that in our generation it is being ignored, and that it's very few people that are not ignoring that, and I'm seeing it more and more now, and it's almost easier to sweep it under the rug with like this BDS movement, anti-Israel movement. And
what is that? What's that about? So I'm not in
sanctions.
Touch with this.
It's so
oh sanctions on Israel
boycott,
for their
BDS is boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Huge movement. Noam Chomsky is a huge proponent of it. It gets me really frustrated with Noam Chomsky. He's not for Israel at all. And so is Roger Waters. Can't stand his thing. You know, he came out with whatever his own version of Je Suis Charlie.
But Gene Simmons is not.
Yeah, Gene Simmons is all right by me. But anyway, it's a big movement, and it is frustrating for me to be a liberal, assimilated American citizen, but that still considers myself very Jewish and wants to be a part of that community and feels for that community, and to see, you know, and to live in a liberal state such as New York and see this stuff going on. It's a little scary for me. It's a little disconcerting. And it's almost a shame, but you know, it's actually a positive thing, but I feel like it's a shame that we feel so comfortable as to be able to do that, because we don't have rockets flying over our heads, and we don't have to deal with living in such close quarters with people that can kill you. We just don't, you know, we don't have to deal with that. And I think that this is leading to something really big, you know, when I really think about it, and it's hard to say, but it's like leading to the next world war is exactly what France did, is ignoring these threats. What I feel France did for years, ignoring a lot of these threats and finally allowing like something like this to happen. And it's happening again in America. And it just happened to us. You know, let's say that these two planes that flew into the World Trade Center were really crazy Muslims, which is also plausible. Okay, could be plausible. And we've forgotten that.
I mean, you know.
And that, you know,
you'd have to really establish the facts of that. I mean, that's what we were told.
Right. Right. Well, I'm saying what we're told, and we've forgotten it.
Oh no, I don't think Americans have forgotten that. I think that there is, look, it's hard to make like one of these incidents, shock doctrine type incident.
Right.
Last for
too long.
14 years.
I know, I get it. And
they've done a good job.
Look,
just, you know, just last year when Obama announced that we, the United States, were going to war with ISIS, the announcement was made on the evening of September 10th.
Right.
I mean,
I do remember that.
Once again is waving the bloody shirt of 9/11.
Right.
How many? That was in 2013. That was 12 years later. That's right. A long time. It's a lot of mileage to get out.
Although I don't know what kind of war we've waged with ISIS. We've taken out a few posts.
It's what kind of war have we waged with Al-Qaeda, which is a, the word means the base, but there is no base. It's completely non-centralized. It is the biggest criticism of the war on terror is how amorphous the whole terror thing is. Like, how do you, first of all, the syntax.
I think if people are shooting at you, you shoot back. Isn't that the case? You go, you're in Afghanistan mountains, you're plopped down there, and there's people there with guns, and they start shooting at you, and you take out the bigger guns, and you shoot them.
like a good Israeli.
Isn't that how Afghanistan, I mean, that's what I'm saying, though.
Well, that's right. That fits as long as it doesn't fit the logic of why you're there, though. Like, the whole concept of going to war with Afghanistan on the premise that bin Laden was trained, that the terrorists were trained there, is a very weak premise. I mean, right? I mean, it doesn't mean it's going to happen again. It doesn't mean that Afghanistan itself had anything to do with it, or the Afghani people.
Right.
And there's a long backstory to Afghanistan. I mean, right. Everybody's tried to conquer Afghanistan.
No, and I'm certainly not saying it's black and white, as though these Afghanistans are terrorists and must be taken out. I can say it's even more so, though, in Israel, when you have terror tunnels being, you know, drilled into your land.
But Americans were sold that lie that we had to go to war with Afghanistan in order to kill the terrorists who did 9/11.
Right.
Then they said, oh, we've got to go to war with Iraq because Iraq and bin Laden are allies, which is not true.
Right.
And so it's hard to see this as to manifest as enlightenment. But I think after more than a decade of war and Americans sacrificing their children and their husbands wives, that there is some weariness about this. And it is so controversial that Congress has not voted on ISIS. They won't vote.
And don't you think
for
that could
or
be
against? It's a totally covert.
Right. And I'm saying that America is completely capable of being able to take a word like terror and change it into something that has opportunities for them and for their businesses. But don't you think that could be another desensitizing factor when Israel has to defend itself, quote unquote, defend itself, and people are saying, we are war weary. We've seen this. There's no point to this.
Okay,
because
so let's take the false flag angle. Let's consider who benefits. I would say if anybody benefits from this, Israel benefits from it now.
From the attacks?
Yeah.
Go on.
Because now lots and lots of people, well, first of all, Hollande got up on TV that night and declared war on the terrorists, who are the Arabs. So he became the enemy of Israel's enemy that day. It was decided. Ooh. It was French policy, and then all the leaders of Europe got together with Turkey guy and Israel guy.
Another vicious anti-Semite, Erdogan.
Oh, yeah. Well, what a complete parade of hypocrisy that was.
Exactly.
Of all these people jailing journalists, including the dude from, what's his name again? I can never remember.
Who, which one?
Prime Minister of England.
Not Cameron.
Yeah.
Cameron.
Yeah, he was, you know, told the Guardian to smash the disk drives with a hammer. You know, it's... The thing is that after a while, I mean, I'm a little older than you, so I have more miles on my clock in terms of seeing the amount of hypocrisy and bullshit that all of these people fling, all of them.
Sure.
So how did Israel benefit from this? Well, now the scales have tipped and lots of people have moved to the right on this issue. Interesting that it's to the right. And that they now agree we've got to do something about this Islamist problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now France has to get on board with dealing with the Islamist problem. And one way, look, it does matter whether it was a staged thing that was, you know, organized and paid for by the taxpayers versus something organized and paid for by a bunch of Islamist radicals, right? It does make a difference. But the net effect is the same effect. It's to tip Europe against the Islamic radicals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think these are movements of complete idiots with a lot of problems, and I think that Charlie Hebdo were kind of complete idiots for doing this, even though I understand their brand of humor. I think France were idiots for not protecting them.
Mm-hmm.
It's so you could slice this any way, and you get a bunch of stupidity leading to a bunch of killing.
Mm-hmm.
And these values of let's go get them back don't ultimately settle things down. And what's going to do that, and how long is it going to take, and who is ultimately benefiting from all this? I mean, what I'm always interested in is in my fantasy world of James Bond investigative reporting, mm-hmm. I could freeze frame an issue like this, like the Charlie Hebdo massacre, and trace the serial number of every gun that the supposed terrorists use. I want to see all of those weapons. I want to know who initially placed the order, and then how many times they changed hands. And I would say that every hand that touched those weapons is an accessory to that crime, whoever the hell it was. But we never know that. And there's very little concern about where the gun came from. In the United States, we're starting to ask, and, you know, there are certain gun shops that seem to have a lot of these guns, you know, that are used in these mass shootings come through them. But what about the guns? You know, what about the weapons? Like, I want to know what the supply of weapons is. Like, I want to know where, for example, all these Islamist radical terrorists are getting their weapons from. Where do they get the supplies to make their IEDs? I recognize they're improvised, and they could, in theory, go to Herzog's and buy all the chemicals. But that's not really Herzog's in Palestine, in the Gaza Strip. There's right. not just like, you know, True Value Hardware, and you can go and get like 25 pounds of saltpeter and fertilizer.
Iran has come out and said that they would happily arm people, and Hezbollah has come out and said that we're in cahoots right. with Iran. And
right. So that we get some motives in there, but what if we could actually see the weapons trace? Mm. I think that would tell us a lot. And in some ways it might settle the argument if we saw the weapons trace, right? There's right. things that could settle the argument of, and the reality is that either this thing was made up by some high powered intelligence agencies, or it was some kind of Islamist militant attack. It's probably one or the other. Now the middle ground is, well, whose hands did those weapons pass through?
Sure.
Who wasn't being followed? What intelligence was ignored? How is it that the guy left his ID card? Like, there's little weird questions that come up. Like, really, people expect people who think to believe that one of these shooters at Charlie Hebdo left his French national ID card in the stolen car. And had he not made that supposed mistake, how would we even know who to blame? Mm. We wouldn't know. So the only reason we know, the only real link to those guys is this national ID card. I think that's a stretch. Now, my therapist, mentor, explained to me all the reasons why someone who's arrogant and inexperienced and under stress
could do that,
and why they would have it. Well, they might have it to get out of the country, but to travel, right? You need your documents to travel, mm-hmm. but you'd really want a real document. You're not going to try to get out some other way. You're not going to like go across the French border into Belgium where there's no border check anymore and sort of like keep disappearing.
I think these people knew that they were going to die as soon as they started shooting up Hebdo. And these people are, if they are fundamentalist Muslims, they're ready to die.
Well, I'm wondering why they didn't wait for that and be real, you know, why they shot their way out and attempted an escape, why they didn't try to destroy the archives. Why, you know, but this is not really my line of work. All I can do is look at it in a way similar to somebody would look at the evacuation of a contaminated neighborhood, and there's really only a few people who would say, hey, why is everyone wearing a moon suit when they're saying that it's safe? Mm-hmm. You know, it's really the trout in the milk, sure. as Thoreau said, to ask that. And the problem with adults is that they tend to not ask these questions, the questions that a child would ask, the questions that someone just looking at it without any ideology would ask.
Right.
And I think that we really do have to do that. And I think we have to, I think, question every government's propaganda.
Right.
Every government's propaganda. Like, I have nothing against Israel. I don't like that's not true. I thought this thing with the Gaza Strip over the summer was agonizing, even to just be feeling it via internet and television.
Sure. I was glued to the internet for it. And I was talking with friends who were there, why they had to run to the bomb shelters.
But look, my bias is pro-Israel. Just as an honorary Jew, as a New Yorker, with, you know, one of these people who just grew up around Jews, who grew up with Golda Meir as my hero, who mm-hmm. understands the plight, who taught Holocaust studies in high school. I didn't study them. I was trained to teach Holocaust studies. So I taught in the one and only Holocaust Studies Center. I've spent time and money visiting concentration camps and learning the history of the Holocaust in person, going to the places, seeing it, touching it. So my bias is pro-Jewish and pro-Israel. So when I question it, it's certainly not coming from an anti-Semitic viewpoint. And you know what's funny is it never even occurred to me that to hypothesize that the Mossad did this was anti-Semitic, because I think, oh, they just happen to be, you know, part of a Jewish state, but it's just they are what they are. They're certainly much more complicated than being
right.
Jewish. It's not like, oh, the Mossad has Manischewitz and matzah every night. It's like they're fucking spies. They're murderers. They're professional murderers. And that's thou shalt not. If you're so Jewish, read your fucking Ten Commandments.
Right. No, I understand that. And I'm not saying that.
Including Bibi. You don't.
I'm not.
The answer is not to kill Palestinians. You find a way. If you're really religious, you find a way.
Right.
The Quakers resigned from office. So, like, we're not going to kill Indians. We're not going to kill them. We quit.
Right.
Oh, really? The state is going to kill Indians? We resign. That's what the Quakers did during right. those.
Well, I don't think it's. I just simply don't think it's that easy anymore.
Not anymore.
We can't do something like that.
Not anymore. And with. But we don't really see acts of conscience on the parts of these powerful people. It's always basically business, politics, and war.
Sure.
I'm sick of it.
Yeah.
I don't believe any. They've been this warmongering. You start to read the story of World War I, World War II, pick any war you want to pick in history. It's basically, it basically always turns out to be business, money, murder, and bullshit.
Sure. Well, the scary part now is with the proliferation of nuclear weapons, you feel like the old Einstein quote is really going to be true, that if World War, I think it was the Einstein quote, right? If World War III happens,
World War IV will be fought with six and stones.
And it's, that, I think that's the big stall right now. And it's scary because to me it feels like something is going to happen. It's inevitable that it's going to happen.
Oh, when you say World War, you're thinking nuclear war?
God. Well, that's what I'm saying is what's happening right now.
That's over fast.
That's over fast.
You don't need a lot of detonations for nuclear winter.
No,
read a book called
saying,
The Fate of the Earth.
I'm not saying
you'll
see that that's
no
what it is.
No way. It's not. We're not even talking sticks and stones. That's the Republic of Insects and Grass.
Sure, definitely. No, I'm not saying that. In fact, that's what I'm saying. Because we have this, there's been such a major stall, and that's why this is kind of feels like this constant underground battling right now. It's almost like it never comes to a head. Not that I want it to come to a head, but you know, it's like what's the end game?
Always stoked. See, it's never. There's a possibility of an end game, but there's also de-escalating. How you de-escalate?
Right.
You know.
And what is that? To give up nuclear weapons?
I don't think this is You know. At some point, we have to, right? I mean. The rest of human eternity is going to be fought, lived under the shadow of the atomic bomb. I mean,
but that's the question. These are serious questions to grapple with. It's not like something that I think people. It's an overwhelming question.
So you were born what year?
87.
Okay, so you're born like the USSR dissolves in 89, right?
Yes.
So you were by the time you were like able to read the New York Times, it was gone.
It's America. It was Bill Clinton at that time. Reading about Bill Clinton.
No. Right.
Yeah.
But you weren't raised under the constant nonstop propaganda of the USSR.
No, certainly not.
When the Sting song, Believe Me When I Say to You, I Hope the Russians Love Their Children Too, came out, that was actually moving. That was deeply moving.
Right.
Because there was this kind of underground drone all the time of the possibility that this whole thing could just go wrong, that a flock of birds could be picked up on the radar as missiles and we end up in a Dr. Strangelove
right.
scenario, which is to me scarier than the intentional, I'm going to push the button, you know, some, you know, president is
which
a little
is
too...
Still, it's, you don't think that's a possibility
sure
today?
It is. Oh, sure it is.
I think it's a possibility any day.
There was a recent article, I forget where, The Atlantic or The New York or someplace like that, that fact-checked Dr. Strangelove. Because when Dr. Strangelove came out, government authorities said, the basic story of Dr. Strangelove is a kind of a mid-level general uses a provision in the kind of war powers policy to start a nuclear war on his own because he's like really against the Ruskies and the
commies. It's a great movie, by the way.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's amazing. And it's educational. It's like almost a documentary because right. when it was fact-checked, it turned out to be actually true. The people on a very low level and that they all had the same password, like all these things, like in the password was like 00001.
Mm-hmm.
Of all these...
Of all the combinations.
Yeah, combinations of nuclear things. Not only do they not have different ones, they all had like login, password, password, like you're not supposed to do in WordPress. You shouldn't say admin password.
Right.
That's how the nuclear bombs were kept. And when those are the level people making the decisions, and how many hundreds of times do we have to hear that before we just realize this is just a bunch of morons? All their ideology, one interpretation of you being, you know, Zionist, dual citizenship Jew is like, oh, you've drank the Kool-Aid. You just believe what these idiots who are only out for money and power, their own money and their own power, are spinning these stories. They're spinning narratives. And now one of our cultural narratives is to question the cultural narrative. Let's stay awake while we're doing it.
No, I see. You know, I can understand that. But it's just...
Scary.
It's scary.
Yes, it's fucking scary to live in this world, to have this stuff happening however it happens is sad and scary. People died on Wednesday. People's families, people who... I believe that all of those people at Charlie Hebdo were killed. It was truly a bunch of journalists who just believed in the job that they had to do and were brave.
Right.
And knew they were working at great risk. They knew that. And that's more than I can say for most journalists who basically, you know, never go anywhere or take any risk or actually talk to a person and find out. They just retype the press release. You know, that was not Charlie Hebdo.
Right. You know, and the reason for my nationalist feelings and the reason that I'm proud is not just because I'm a Jew, it is also because of Israel, and I really do feel like a Zionist, and I guess it was the way I was brought up, but you know, knowing that there is a home for Jewish people and that there is actually a place, I mean, just being there was like a beautiful thing for me, being around there. So that being a whole different thing, not about a geopolitical issue again or something like, you know, political even confrontations with the Palestinians.
Reb Daniel.
No, it was nice.
That is beautiful. But guess where you are right now? You're in New York.
Yeah.
And we are one of the best places ever in the history of Judea for Jews to be.
Definitely. Oh, I agree with that 100%. But
where there's not only are there not rockets flying... And those, I don't think those airplanes are going to come back because they can't do that twice. But the beauty of New York is that Jews are people. I mean, I've actually had to have anti-Semitism explained to me. I mean, that's how, like, really?
Right.
To people, what do you mean? But they don't like Jack and Sheila? You know, they weren't, Jack and Sheila weren't Jewish people. They were people. The Gil and Sandy weren't Jewish people. They were people.
Right. But that's not the case for a lot of people now, Eric. That's
but in
not.
New York, it's as, I think, as safe as any place in the world.
I'm very happy
and
to
if
be
I
America.
Were Jewish, I would probably live in New York and think, okay, I'm in New York. That's as good as it gets.
New York is amazing. However, I see it right in New York, right in the Hudson Valley, this what they talk about, an anti-Zionist movement and BDS movement. I see it going on right here, and it's scary as a Jew to
actually
see that.
Well, that's a topic for... I mean, I would like to dig into what they're saying and read some of Chomsky's pieces on this.
Definitely should.
Because it's something I haven't even read a word of. I'm aware that it exists. I mean, I'm aware that there's been a movement to attempt to temper Israel's treatment.
Right, and the reason that I know about it is really because of the music scene. It came through. I mean, I know about it because Roger Waters canceled an appearance. A lot of bands canceled appearances in Israel, and so now it's a big thing when a band goes out, like Rolling Stones, we're like, no, we're going to go over there and play. And it was like hugely popular, and everybody was big fans of the Rolling Stones for actually going to do this. Neil Young had to cancel his appearance because of the war that was going on in the summer, and instead donated his money. And I love what Neil Young did, donated his money to Palestinian and Jewish charities.
Charities,
you know, co-charity. Right. Co-charity. They're owned by both Palestinian and Jewish people. So he and gave actually the money that he would have made. Let's say he would have made $100,000. He donated that $100,000. And he didn't make that $100,000 because he canceled the show. Yeah. It's very, very cool what he did. But there's a lot of people out there that are, you know, not just unsupportive of Israel, but but it's almost like it's hip to be anti-Israel. And it's certainly scary. It can be scary. And not saying that I'm ostracized in New York. It's much quieter. But something like this, seeing that this stuff goes on in France and seeing that this stuff is happening outside of Israel, now it feels like, hey, this is the time to talk about it. So I wanted to talk about it with you.
Absolutely. Yes. Apropos of all, you know, of this incredible bigotry that we're seeing in our time in history. Mm. You know, there's so much.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there, you know, it's like, and it's kind of all the same thing. You know, it's killing in the name of difference.
Mm.
Over and over again. Shalom.
Ain't it the truth?
May this end.
May this end.
And may God bless and keep the Tsar far away from us.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming over, Dan.
Yeah,
I've missed studying guitar for a couple of weeks.
We'll get back to that too.
As of we're recording on Thursday night, Planet Waves has just come out, and I've got Friday to write Pisces, and then I'm going to hopefully tie up the audio editing and posting for the annual edition on Saturday. And what we're talking about, you work on Sunday, you're going to do a guitar lesson on Monday.
Monday. We'll start on Monday.
All right, good. We'll start on Monday. And I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Bye for now. All right. So let's go out with one more song by Lost at Last. And what is this one called? This one is called, oh man, I'm drawing a blank here. That's my mind on adrenaline. Ocean of Mercy. Chosen before knowing this was going to be a bit of a conversation with many violent images and ideas being expressed. So I leave you in the capable hands of Om, the singer, and Lost at Last. Bye for now.